ID code 2899. My guest tonight has spent countless hours at the National Archives doing research on reports of UFOs and Foo Fighter reports from World War II era. Keith has also been fortunate enough to interview many people who served in our armed forces during World War II who had sightings of anomalous objects. Keith's book, Strange Company, Military Encounters with UFOs in World War II, is a fascinating and a very well-researched book, which I would highly recommend to anyone. I am pleased and honored to welcome Keith back to the program tonight. Thank you for joining us again this evening, Keith.
Thanks a lot for inviting me. Glad to be on.
I've had you on before talking about your book. For those who aren't familiar with it yet, you want to kind of give a little bit of a background on it?
Sure. It all started in 1989. I was about to begin my first witness investigation, and I needed to figure out a way to approach the subject without scaring her away and do it in a professional manner. And it had to do with the crash and retrieval situation. This teacher in Frederick County, Maryland, had told her classes that she knew about the UFO phenomenon firsthand. And what happened was in 1969, she worked at the Pentagon for the Office of Defense. She was hired there as a secretary for CETA, which was a civilian employment training agency. She was going to college, and that was used to help finance her way through school. She happened to be the secretary to a Colonel Sullivan, and it was just Colonel Sullivan and herself working in the office for the Office of Civil Defense in the Pentagon. And at one time, Colonel Sullivan had a meeting with several other officers, she believes they were Army, discussing a crashed UFO and what they should do with it. As a good secretary, she tried to ignore it, but her office had joined them very close, and she remembered that. So I guess around 1989, 1990, the Roswell story was starting to break in a lot of the literature. This is just prior to Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt's book, Crash at Roswell. And so I found out about this teacher through a friend who happened to be in her class. And what I wanted to do, since it was crash and retrieval related, I contacted Leonard Stringfield, who was well known at the time for being strictly involved with crash and retrieval cases. Of course, Mr. Stringfield had a long history with UFO research and probably well known among the historians and ufologists for decades. He was more than willing to help me out with the case and mentor me through the interview with her. And that did not go too well. Her interview with me was very, very short. She did talk with me. She relayed the story as told to the students, but she didn't feel comfortable, and I just dropped it. But in the meantime, I became fast friends with Mr. Stringfield. And for those who don't know about Mr. Stringfield, he was a 5th Air Force officer with the intelligence capacity with the 5th Air Force, of course, flying into Japan just after the Nagasaki bombing. And it was during that flight in that he had a daytime sighting. This would be August 28, 1945. So I became extremely fascinated with that because I had never heard a World War II veteran speak so much in detail about an encounter. I put it aside for about 10 years, knowing I wanted to write a book about the subject. Unfortunately, Mr. Stringfield passed away in 93. So I wanted to make sure that, of course, I had his firsthand account. But before I went into a full-fledged investigation, I wanted to find out if there indeed was some type of documentation that had come out of the government that indeed stated there was a phenomenon occurring during the war. And that came out of a 1953 report called the Robertson Panel Report. Many of you may have heard of this. It was chaired by Dr. Robertson, H.P. Robertson, and it was CIA-backed project for several of the eminent scientists around the country to meet in Washington to discuss if UFOs were a national security threat. This is 1953. It had to do with the 1947 through 1952 sightings. There were so many sightings around the United States and the world, it was becoming a national security issue in terms of air defense, if it indeed was something that was Soviet in nature. So in that report, that 1953 Robertson Pound report, it talked about the Foo Fighters, and that was pretty much passed off as some type of meteorological or astronomical phenomena. But most interestingly, what was in the report was a section called On Lack of Danger. And in there it stated, quote, if the term flying saucers had been popular in 1943 through 1945, these objects would have been so labeled. That just leaped off the page at me, and I thought, well, if they're calling it meteorological phenomena, that sentence shouldn't be in there to begin with. So I realized there was obviously more to the subject, and of course, Mr. Stringfield's firsthand account really reflected there was something more to be told, and apparently the CIA were holding back, and it was more of a sanitized version of the report, was my thinking. So I decided, well, I needed more, of course, firsthand witness accounts, but that just doesn't get you very far because of misidentification and lack of knowledge, compartmentalization within their capacity. So I decided to go to the National Archives for 4 years on a weekly basis and just dig through the record groups, the Army Air Force, Office of Scientific Research and Development, the CIA, the Office of Strategic Services, which was the predecessor to the CIA, of course, Department of the Army, and on and on. And over the course of the next 4 years, I would dig up documents that indicated there was a phenomenon. And then what really nailed it down was General Eisenhower's office in 1944 through 45 actually had memoranda talking about the night phenomenon. So basically, I just put together this documentation with witness accounts and some of the old periodicals and material that had been published through the decades to assemble this as a pretty much a foundation for others to build upon. It's, while in depth, it's far from comprehensive.
We're having a little bit of difficulty hearing you. It's kind of quiet from your end, if you could speak it just a bit. I was fascinated with Len Stringfield's incident, I guess you could call it,
mm-hmm.
on his way to Japan. I've been doing some reading here lately on electromagnetic interference with everything from nuclear missiles to cars to aircraft and, you know, on people and all kinds of things. In Leonard's account, he talks about how they thought they were going to have to ditch the aircraft because of some engine problems.
That's correct. What happened was when Mr. Stringfield, he was in a C-46 transport aircraft, along with, I guess, another dozen men or so. And the co-pilot came back. He heard some commotion in the cockpit. The co-pilot came back and said, prepare yourself for a crash landing. Now, they were over open ocean between the islands of Iwo and Iwo Jima, and hundreds of miles out, nothing around them. And about the time the co-pilot came back to warn of the crash, Stringfield looked out and saw what he thought to be three objects the size of dimes, an arm length, parallel to the aircraft. And he realized that the aircraft was losing altitude. Once they disappeared, after a few moments, they did regain control of the aircraft. And it was post-event that Mr. Stringfield was able to find out there was some type of malfunction with the aircraft engine dials and all the instruments up in the cockpit, but he did see for himself that the left side of the aircraft, which he was sitting on, the engine had leaked oil all the way along the aircraft, and he assumed that the incident that was the same as far as what he saw may have caused these problems. He couldn't verify it, but the coincidence was highly likely that it did happen in that fashion, according to people he spoke with after the war.
They had everybody pretty darn scared. They thought they were going to have to ditch in the middle of the Pacific.
Yes. A side note to that, Mr. Stringfield, of course, was a sergeant with the Army Air Force. He got out in 1945, and he told this to Dick Hall, another famous UFO researcher in the field, that it scared him so much he never did anything but take mass transportation. He never flew again after the war. He would always take a bus, a train, or a car. That's how much that event scared him.
Wow. I wasn't aware of that aspect. So it was through Leonard that you got started on this.
Exactly.
Did he introduce you to other flyers, or did you find them on your own, or how did you find these gentlemen?
Well, I had to find them on my own because Mr. Stringfield was very close-lipped. I think a lot of researchers may know that he really respected anonymity. And he wasn't one to pass out names freely. And so I decided, well, by the time I was ready to actually do serious research in World War II, he had passed away, unfortunately. And so I wanted to figure out, well, where do I start? Well, what I had learned was that this is something that's very important to the listeners to understand, that the term Foo Fighter was a term that only existed from December of 1944 through about March or April of 1945. And that term was actually given by one American night fighter unit, the 415th Night Fighter Squadron. It was a name that the guys who had seen them in that particular unit just decided to call it. And what is understood is that the name Foo Fighter came from a Smokey Stover cartoon that was very popular in the 1940s. And the fire engine that was in that particular cartoon was called the Foo Mobile. And so that's how the name came to be. But what it's not understood is when we discussed UFO sightings during the war, Foo Fighter was really only one term applied. And the sightings went all the way back to 1942, that is actually, you know, documented under various names. And that's a difficult thing to deal with, because when I went through all the documentation at the National Archives, this terminology really didn't describe a lot of what was being seen by the actual pilots. They would call some UFO events a rocket, a flare, a balloon, just like today. For lack of term, analogy, they just tried to give it something that they could relate to, because they were not thinking extraterrestrial. They were thinking this was German and Japanese technology being thrown at them for the first time. But as the war progressed, they realized the conventional answers weren't there.
And a lot of these guys, at first, they didn't really know how to report what they were seeing, or did they just say, hey, we saw this, and everybody just started speculating on what it was?
Well, generally, during the combat missions or just in flight, these guys were pretty solid characters. I mean, most of them were hardened veterans in terms of combat. Usually, by the time that they had their sightings, the ones that, you know, had been reported, they pretty much could discern what a jet was, what a flare was, what an ME-109 was in combat, what a rocket was, and they were pretty cool under fire. But some of the most extraordinary accounts, the ones that unnerved them, were the accounts that were actually going against what they assumed was a balloon. or a jet or a rocket. And so they reported them as what they thought they were, and then of course their reports were either sanitized or were two type of reports were made and sent up the channels of command for them to do the analyzation, the intelligence officers. The guys in the aircraft, they were just worried about getting home, getting back on the ground. But they were excellent observers, and that's the key point here, especially the night fighter pilots. A very interesting statistic is that I believe there was 20,000 pilots trained for World War II, American forces. Only 400 and some were night fighter pilots because of the exceptional, I guess, demands on them. Their sight had to be exceptional. These guys were flying by the seat of their pants, using radar for the first time, and it took a certain breed of character to really do that. And so when they saw an object, they were coolly reporting it. And when the Foo Fighters came on the scene, they realized after about a month that these objects had to be German secret weapons because they weren't the V-2, they weren't the V-1, they were not the ME-262, which was the jet-propelled aircraft that had just come on the scene the summer before, or the rocket-powered aircraft, ME-163. These were the high-technology weaponry that the Germans were putting up in the air. And not long after they were presented to the American forces, the pilots on our side were able to really pretty much understand how to combat those issues and what they looked like. So it was a pretty quick identification. And at that time, they realized what they were seeing by, you know, I guess early 1945 can be called a phenomenon.
We're all having a little difficulty hearing you. It's real quiet coming through.
Okay. I'll try to keep it closer to my mouth. Is that better?
Oh, that's perfect.
Okay.
Okay. You know, you mentioned radar. Now, radar was pretty much in its infancy in that era. In fact, it was developed during World War II. And these night fighters, they were basically the first aircraft to be outfitted with in-craft radar. Now, were these guys, were they picking any of this stuff up on their radar, or was it strictly visual?
More often than not, they would have a visual sighting, but their radar would not pick it up. So when you view it through the eyes of technology, we're talking about if they were indeed German aircraft, we're talking about a stealth technology, a stealth paint, or some other countermeasure that was unknown at the time. But this is 1944, late 1945. Germany was on the decline. We had pretty much bombed the industry into submission, and they weren't putting too much new technology in the air at the time. So when they encountered these objects and they were not on the radar, then they realized, wow, this is pretty fascinating. So the intelligence teams had to figure out, well, what were they using to counter our radar? And of course, that was never explained, if it indeed was that. But when you talk to the pilots and they tell you what they saw as far as the performance, it wasn't matching the known technology of the day. So that made it even scarier for them. They were calling the incidents like Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon events, because it was truly like out of science fiction.
Okay, that was something I had meant to ask you last time we were on, and I have my answers. That was really good. You interviewed, 12 men?
It was about 12, yes.
Yes, and were their descriptions pretty much the same, or did they vary?
They were pretty much the same. The ones that I actually interviewed, except for Mr. Stringfield. His was the most extraordinary. However, several of the pilots I interviewed, they were willing to go on record stating that they did not believe that it was German technology. And they realized that post-war, as the years went on, they realized that they could not account for what they were seeing developed in the United States Air Force to account for what they had seen during the war, and that surprised them. And then, of course, when the UFO phenomenon really kicked in, and by 1952, when, of course, newspapers and Time,
the infamous flap over D.C.
Yeah, and all that took place, and then they were saying, wow, that's what I was seeing in some instances. So it was really, again, I have to stress that during the war, most of the pilots were thinking German technology. But it still, the extraordinary accounts were definitely something that unnerved them. And unfortunately, those extraordinary accounts have not been found in paper form. We've only found clues that they did exist. And of course, that, you know, their testimony, which I'm not one to call them liars. And when you actually talk with them and you understand that they do understand what conventional technology at the time was, then you're willing to accept that, yes, they did experience something pretty special.
Now, on all these men, how do I phrase this question? Was there any kind of a psychological effect on these men, you know, from their experiences, or did they just kind of shrug it off, or what?
Well, all but Mr. Stringfield, and of course, I think Mr. Stringfield's reaction to flying had to do with he almost crashed in the ocean. Maybe not particularly the sighting itself, but most of the other guys I spoke with were just, it was another day of business. They were curious. The ones I spoke with weren't really scared. They became angry that when they tried to engage the objects in combat, they couldn't, and that really frustrated them. I have one account where one of the pilots became so frustrated, his radar operator went up with him with a Thompson submachine gun to fire out the cockpit at these objects when they got close, because any time that they would turn into them to either attack head-on or get behind them, the objects would disappear, and in some instances appear behind them after they lost sight of them. So it was more of a cat-and-mouse game. Most of the guys I spoke with were anxious to shoot them down, but they weren't running scared by any means. They just did what they could and got their aircraft back, because, of course, they had to worry about German night fighters also. You know, the Germans had aircraft up there, too, at night. So it was a pretty hectic time.
How many of these incidents, or would these pilots have... you know, more than one incident happened. Was it happening a lot, or just an infrequent appearance?
Well, with the 415th Night Fighter Squadron, who named them the Foo Fighters, that particular unit I zeroed in on, everyone in that unit, I guess there were 30 or 40 pilots at the most, had seen the objects multiple times, including the commanding officer, who went up because he couldn't believe, he wanted to see what was going on, what all the big hullabaloo was with his pilots. You know, they were coming back like, you know, there's something up there, we can't identify it, and it could be a threat, we don't know. So there were multiple sightings by these pilots with that one unit. And of course, there were sightings by almost all the night fighter units, of course. But primarily the ones I actually spoke with were with the 415th Night Fighter Squadron.
Now, there was also some reporters that were looking into this. I've read bits and pieces of some of their articles, and, you know, it's a little bit mirroring, so to speak, our media today, the way it's covered. Some of it's skeptical, some of it's not so skeptical. How do you see the way the media was covering it then as compared to what media coverage is of UFO reports today?
Well, it was pretty much like today. it may not have been at so many, but the reporters and the newspapers and the magazines at the time, they were basically people, scientists, who were back in the States, who weren't in combat, who were not near the front lines, assessing the situation from the reports that were being, you know, let out by the Associated Press or the unit, you know, press or whatever, and they would come up with their ideas of what it was, and in some instances saying, oh, these guys are just, you know, it's war nerves, it is misidentification, it's meteorological phenomena, it's flares that they don't identify because of you know, their combat situation, where the plane is at the time, and what was happening. The pilots were becoming very upset at this, and they were saying, look, you know, I'm not insane, and these men who are telling us what we saw were not here. And while it's understandable that the papers and the press and the scientists would want to explore all possibilities, you know, St. Elmo's fire or electromagnetic disturbances that are a phenomena that we're not really used to, ball lightning, whatever, that's all understandable. But the press and some of these scientists were actually insulting what these gentlemen were seeing. And that, you know, that was really a slap in the face, considering these guys were in combat and they were excellent observers.
Now, of course, they had to be in order to be doing the job they were doing. These guys were they were very brave men. I mean, consider some of the flak, literally, they had to fly through.
Absolutely. I mean, I guarantee one time of being in a B-17 bomber and encountering a flak attack, it certainly brought a real sobriety to the whole situation quickly. And the fact that these guys would go back out on multiple missions, and they knew there was a great chance they weren't coming back. The odds were really against them. If it wasn't flak, anti-aircraft fire, it was German fighters or rockets. You know, something that was on the scene they had to worry about. So it was a real mess. And but a lot of the major sightings were not in combat. That's what makes it remarkable. These guys were able to really observe and determine, you know, what it was or was not, in their opinion.
And not only did you collect reports from the air, you know, from pilots and people who were on board other aircraft, you also found some reports from the ground. There was one in particular, and I'm trying to remember where it was, where this gentleman was in a foxhole and happened to roll over and look up, and here was over 100 craft over him.
Yes, that was an account where he was, I forget the island he was on, Iwo Jima, it might be Iwo Jima, Guadalcanal maybe. Sorry, I have it incorrectly, but yes, he was in a foxhole and he heard a drone and looked up and saw a strange formation. These objects were about 100 to 150 in number, but they weren't flying in V formation like you would look up and see our squadrons fly in, or any other of the Japanese, and actually it was Okinawa. And so he saw that, and they were flying in straight lines, which was very unusual. And they were flying higher than, after he realized what he was looking at, they were flying higher than any of the bombers, high-altitude bombers we had. So there were those observations, and I'm sure there was a lot more to be accounted for, but I did not come across too much of that because I was strictly looking at the Army Air Force and the Royal Air Force in the air type of society. But what I was told by the 415th Night Fighter Squadron pilots was that on several occasions they were in communication with the ground, who did not see on their radar what they were looking out their cockpit and seeing right in front of them. And some of the sizes varied. Some were the size of a dime, so that could be, it was far away, to the size of their aircraft. And these were circular balls, phosphorescent in color. Very seldom. I only have one account where they actually saw what appeared to be some type of physical structure. But they apparently were intelligently controlled and very sophisticated and could travel what they estimated at thousands of miles per hour in some instances, which was just, like I said, a Buck Rogers, you know, report.
On these bombing runs that they used to take, they were usually flying fairly low. If I'm understanding correctly, they would sometimes see them coming up over hills and just from out of everywhere.
No, generally, what you said is correct, though. Coming out of nowhere. That's a very, very common statement, that they just appeared out of nowhere. And typically, most of the sightings that I'm aware of were at night. And that, you know, again, one can question, one can say, playing the devil's advocate, oh, it was just, you know, German technology, and then they decided to put on their lights. Well, that's possible, but what sense does it make to illuminate your aircraft in combat? So
exactly.
They, coming out of nowhere, not being seen on radar, performing flight characteristics that could outdo any American aircraft, including the German ME-262 jet-propelled aircraft, which was considered the most sophisticated aircraft of the day. These weren't even performing in that manner. They were far superior to that manner. But what really made it strange was they were circular and saucer shaped and cigar shaped, just like today, just like the late 1940s on into the 1950s. They were the predecessor sightings, and this type of terminology was being used: cigar shaped, saucer shaped, oblong. That was terminology being used in the actual mission report that I did uncover. So that, you know, it really stands to reason these guys were not seeing, you know, a Japanese Zero or an ME-109 or whatever, you know, a fixed-wing aircraft.
Were there many daytime sightings? You know, the only photographs I've seen of Foo Fighters look like they were taken in the daytime. How many sightings were found or were reported during the day?
Well, to my knowledge, I only have three or four that I'm aware of off the top of my head, but obviously there's more. Like I said, my investigation is far from comprehensive. And as far as the photographs go, there's probably, a dozen photographs of alleged Foo Fighter sightings, and there's no provenance behind these photographs. While one or two appear to be authentic, there's still no real understanding of where they came from, who produced it, and so there's that question mark there. It is gun camera footage. Another instance, I know of no instance of daytime or nighttime gun camera footage, even though it was stated that that footage was taken. However, as far as I know, that is still classified.
Oh, wouldn't it be interesting to find it and be able to watch it?
Oh, absolutely. Interestingly enough, speaking of gun camera footage, a friend of mine sent me a link of new footage that was recently declassified of an American P-47 prop aircraft, in combat. This was combat footage. That tells me if they're still releasing mundane footage, that means there's still quite a bit there that probably does incorporate, you know, the more phenomenal type of sightings or whatever it was they were capturing on film, because cameras were everywhere. There were photographic units on the bombers. There were handheld cameras. There were fixed cameras. So there was definitely an effort, especially after the phenomenon occurred, you know, and we have to realize this phenomenon was occurring before the American forces came on the scene in 1942. The Royal Air Force were encountering it. So my guess is that the investigations were in place by the time the United States Air Force joined the British in 1942 to look into the phenomenon, to at the very least photograph it, to analyze it. So I'm sure there's much that hasn't been released.
This is something I've often wondered. Now, I'm not sure where the Germans had been doing their heavy water research and production and their research into atomic weapons. But I do know that at the time that the United States was doing their research into atomic weapons, that there were often reports of strange things in the sky. Is there any idea that whether or not any of these Foo Fighters were appearing in the same areas where the Germans were doing their atomic research?
I know of nothing. Unfortunately, there is a big black hole of lack of information regarding the German angle on this, or the Japanese, or the Italian. There's very little documentation that really shows how big the phenomenon was. We understand it did occur, but around, as far as Germans and the Japanese, I was unable, of course, because of the language barrier, to go into their archives. And I don't know of any other researcher who has really put together a book on the German perspective. What I did gather through my investigation, talking with other researchers, was the fact that most Germans do not believe there was a UFO phenomenon during the war. They believe it was indeed highly classified German technology. You'll find more behind that than not. And I only make that statement, you know, I put it out there because, there are German researchers who do believe and do understand there was a phenomenon. I'm just saying what I came across specific to the World War II area, that's what we're dealing with. Now, as far as the Foo Fighters or whatever they were being encountered up near nuclear sites, there was one in the United States that's been documented, and that was at the Hanford Atomic Reactor site. And that took place in mid-July 1945, and they actually captured a object with oval-shaped and the size of an egg, pinkish in color, that hovered above the facility at about 42,000 and above feet. And the object was pursued by five Hellcat aircraft coming out of the naval station in Pasco. And unfortunately, it disappeared. So there were stateside sightings. There were civilian sightings. A tremendous amount. Of course, my book does not go into that. But it wasn't unheard of. So again, We have to realize that my investigation really needs to expand into the civilian end of this to show the breadth of it, to show how big it was around the world.
Well, in the back of your book, you have a great index of sightings and the date, where, what was seen. It's a wonderful compilation of information at a touch. It's just right there.
Yeah, I felt it was probably needed to show how often things were observed, and I thought it was nice to see the chronology of it, to see that, wow, you know, this wasn't something that happened a couple times, you know, and there were many more sightings, and like I said, the real trouble I had with my investigation was terminology. 99.9% of the time, I was looking at mission reports that were describing rockets, that were describing flares, that were describing jets or lights. And I had to discern, well, wait a minute, is that really what they saw, or is that just a term they applied to it? And so much was left out, and you would probably see a chronological list for every day just coming out of the Army Air Force of strange sightings. And what makes it interesting is in the mission report there was actually a section allocated, and it was called Phenomenon, or Phenomena Sightings. And in there, it would show the actual sighting using the term rocket, rocket-like, saucer-shaped, meteor, projectile, whatever term they were going to use. But interestingly enough, since they didn't understand it, it was put in that category as phenomenon. So among that, among all these hundreds of sightings, thousands probably, there were probably a good deal of high strangeness that could not be accounted for. And I'm sure they were conducting investigations. That's absolutely, a fact.
Also, towards the back of the book, there's several documents in the back that you found while going through the archives. And several of them, quite a few of them, if not all of them, are actual written reports from some of these incidences. From, gosh, let's see, October, or excuse me, flip to the first one again, May 26th, 1943, was the first one there. And I thought it was kind of interesting that not only did it have an American secret coding, U.S. confidential, but it was also marked as British secret.
Yes, that's because we were sharing intelligence on all fronts, may it be political, economic, military, personality, whatever. We were sharing with the British, and so in the very beginning, the British were flying with our bombers during the day, because we were doing the daytime bombing missions, and the British were conducting the nighttime. And they would a lot of times put what they called a flak liaison officer in with the American crew to acclimate them to what they were going to encounter, flak-wise, aircraft-wise, searchlight-wise, and determine if the pilots and the crews were handling themselves sufficiently, since they had a lot of experience, the British. And so it was just right from the outset, right when the Americans joined the war effort, there was a complete agreement that there would be shared intelligence. And so if an American mission report was brought into the command, British would be aware of it. So, and we had access to theirs too. So it was common shared knowledge and information.
There's this one document in here from the F-2 officer, Major W.E., and I believe it's Dolan. In his report, he says, line number one, no attacks made on our formation today. And then at the bottom of that, he's saying, ball-like object appeared silvery, hung in the air at 30,000 feet. No chute was observed to be attached to the object, and it remained under observation for approximately 15 minutes by the crew while in the target area. The crew did not see the object fired from the ground. Now, is that a typical report on these objects?
Exactly. That's exactly what I was trying to explain to your listeners. Here we will see in this report the terminology issue. Now, you have to realize this was the intelligence officer, the S-2 officer, squadron level, who was reporting what the air crew were telling him. And you have to realize this is a sanitized report. This is a report that was condensed to go up the chain of command from squadron level to wing level to bomb group level to the command level in Washington, in London. And so, interestingly enough, you have to realize that the brevity of the report is very telling, because it says, like you said, ball-like object. Well, it tells me when you start to talk like that, you're trying to identify something, and you're saying, well, if it's a balloon, you would have called it a balloon. So they just call it a ball-like object. So this is 1944, they knew what balloons looked like, and these are daytime missions, so and nighttime missions. So it's very telling when you see these kind of reports that, you know, the crew did not see an object fired from the ground. Well, that's important because that was the things that the crews were trying to determine. They were trying to say, oh, was this a rocket being fired from an installation? And if so, why haven't we seen any indication that's the case? So, again, this is a sanitized report, what I call sanitized, and we don't know, you know, everything that was being told actually made it to that particular report. There could have been a second report generated by those who questioned further.
How many countries, back up a little bit, we understand that the United States and England were investigating this, you know, because we were allies. Is there any idea how many other countries were looking into it?
I'm just assuming that the Italians were looking into it, the Germans were looking into it, the Canadians, the French. I think everybody who had an Air Force up there, if indeed what we're talking about was something strange, something unusual in the sky, just out of pure necessity to determine if they were being threatened by a combat weapon, the Air Force Intelligence mission was to collect, collate, and identify, to the best of their knowledge, what it was so they could devise ways to combat. And unfortunately, I don't know of any investigations. This alleged Italian investigations took place. But with the German side, I have no idea. Other than comments that were made by during the post-war of United States air intelligence officers, one who stated that during interrogations, it was learned that the Germans were thinking that some of the sightings that they had were our objects, and they were, you know, actually correlating that the sightings were seen by both the Americans and the Germans at the same time at some instances. So there was it tells me there was an investigation by the Germans, or had to have been, just out of the plausibility of the scenario. I think what was occurring dictates that it would have happened. Unfortunately, I just can't state that for a fact.
That's a question from our audience.
Sure.
Gossamer777 asked, did any of these reports get sent to higher up, whose names became recognizable in UFO lore later on in the 1940s or 50s, General so-and-so or Admiral so-and-so?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, the first time that we know that there was an actual phenomenon occurring was due to the January memoranda that was coming out of General Eisenhower's office. And you have to realize that General Eisenhower's office, he was seeing this intelligence coming in. And interestingly enough, the scientific advisor to General Eisenhower was no other than Dr. H.P. Robertson, who in 1953 headed the panel for the CIA to determine if UFOs were a national security threat. So I'd say the most telling, most remarkable documentation that has come out would be from what I uncovered through General Eisenhower's office. And of course, it's the first time in my book that this documentation has been seen, because it was recently discovered by me. I guess it was probably 2006 is when I uncovered it, 2005. So it came right out of his headquarters. So that would probably be the most famous right now that I'm aware of.
That's interesting. I was wondering along the lines of General Stanford, who did a lot of talking at the 1952 conference concerning the Washington D.C. double weekend event.
Exactly. Which led up to the 1953 Robertson panel meeting. That was part of that. Those sightings were part of that. So General Sanford was well versed in what was occurring probably during the war and after. There's no doubt in my mind, of course, we had to find that connection, but I can tell you one thing. In 1949, Kehoe had access to contacts at the Pentagon, and he was informed that there was indeed an 8th Air Force investigation of the UFO, of the Foo Fighters. So when it goes to that high level, which we know it existed, there's no doubt the command, the generals of many commands were at least briefed on the subject, at the very least.
On that note, we need to go to a break, and so we'll be back here in about 8 to 9 minutes on Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, and UPRN 105.3 New Orleans.
Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Now here's your host, D. Andrew.
And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.3 New Orleans. I'm your host, D. Andrew, and tonight we've been speaking with Keith Chester, author of the book Strange Company, Military Encounters with UFOs in World War II. Keith, a lot of these cases, not just from the night fighters on the American side, but also British pilots were seeing these. Have you been able to come up with much information on the British end of it?
As far as the British goes, I'd say the leading researcher would be, at this time, Dr. David Clark, and also Andy Roberts. I think Andy's in Wales, I'm not sure, but Dr. Clark is in London, and he has been going through the archives in London called the Public Records Office, and he has uncovered through the years some of the more remarkable sightings that the RAF had encountered. Now, many of my sightings, of course, were Army Air Force generated. They would acknowledge British sightings, of course, because they were, like I said, in liaison with each other in terms of combat missions, intelligence gathering, whatever. So, yes, I have to say that the PRO has a couple gems, as you would call that would support there was something significant. And one of those was a 1942 sighting on November 28th over Turin, Italy. And a RAF squadron had been flying near the Alps when they encountered an object. They called it an object in their report that was 200 to 300 feet in length and traveling around 500 miles per hour. And according to them, the object had four red lights that looked like they were spaced equally along the body of the object. Now, that particular report, you know, was turned in to what they called the number 5 group, who happened to be the group that were part of the British phenomena investigation. Now, they called it a rocket phenomenon. They didn't, you know, it wasn't a Foo fire. This was in 1943 when this is occurring, when they actually, we know that an actual investigation did occur. It could have occurred prior to this, but the documentation we have, I've uncovered, shows that it did occur in 1943. And what's remarkable about this sighting was, of course, they knew it wasn't a Zeppelin, or it appeared to be flying under intelligent control, not acting like a Zeppelin. And, of course, it was flying too fast for that. It wasn't a meteorological balloon, which they were familiar with, or a rocket. And interestingly enough, when they turned in their report, this is one of the times that you get a sense that the crews themselves were being ridiculed. So I'm going to quote here from the bomber command that received a report from the intelligence officer. Quote, herewith a copy of a report received from a crew of a Lancaster after raid on Turin. The crew refuses to be shaken in their story in the face of the usual banter. That means a lot of times when these airmen were coming in and reporting what they had seen, the intelligence operatives who were taking the report were saying, well, you've been drinking, or there's no such type of technology in existence. That couldn't be a rocket. That had to be a balloon, on and on. And, of course, that occurred, and what they were realizing was that that kind of ridicule was causing the pilots not to report, because the last thing a pilot wants to do is to be grounded because he has been considered psychologically not fit for combat. So they completely changed their tune as late war occurred and started, you know, get the reports in, don't ridicule, and ask questions, get the information in. So, but in the beginning, there was a lot of problem with the situation. But the fact that the British were reporting it before the Americans had actually joined in, and they actually wrote several reports with the term phenomena or phenomenon in it in the early 1940s. So it is significant.
Okay, also you mentioned that the Canadians, were you able to dig up anything on the Canadian side of the story?
I was unable to, again, only because I did not go into the Canadian archives. I was strictly, my investigation took place primarily at the National Archives in College Park, which houses the Army Air Force records, and that was primarily what I looked at. And it was only a tip of the iceberg. I could still be there now looking at all the records that exist, just there. The only thing I uncovered was a message that had come out of the Canadian Royal Police talking about an object that was observed to be traveling in one direction, dropping another object, and what they assumed was a balloon, both of these objects, and that object traveled away in the opposite direction. So it was a very classic case as looked through the eyes of ufology, as maybe a mothership dropping some type of reconnaissance aircraft. However, they state it was a balloon, yet they couldn't properly identify it as such. So here again, you know, we know that things were taking place in Canada, and Don Ledger, one of the big UFO researchers currently involved there now, he is actively involved trying to uncover what the Royal Canadian Air Force had put in their files, if they do exist. We also have to realize a tremendous amount of documentation. I'd say 90% of all the British documentation up to, I know this will sound crazy, but 1990 was destroyed on purpose because they felt it held no significant value post-World War II, especially 2009. So what Dr. Clark has realized is that an invaluable amount of information has been lost due to just no appreciation for history. And regarding destruction of documentation on my end, I can't tell you how many boxes of information I came across at the National Archives that showed the slating of destruction of documents. And what it would be a box, I'd open a box, there'd be folder after folder of pages full of reports. And I wouldn't know what those reports pertained to. They were just numbered, and they were slated for destruction. And so that was destroyed. Also, my communications with Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Up until the 1960s, there was absolutely no, other than after they, got the documentation they felt was important technologically wise, there was no real effort by anyone for history. And he said many times a commanding officer would go into an office, and there, let's say there would be five filing cabinets, and four of those filing cabinets had Air Force technology reports, intelligence reports, summaries, a whole gambit. They'd say, we are now at war with the Russians, not the Germans. I want those files destroyed out of my office. And they would just dump them. There would be no, there was no historian on base or on site to retrieve them. If the documents were retrieved, they were done so by people who realized their importance and grabbed them for themselves or other areas, but it was just hit or miss. So that's a real, there's a real loss of record of World War II due to document destruction.
That's borderline criminal. I mean, if you look at the controversy over a bunch of records of the era covering the time frame of the Roswell crash at the Roswell Army Air Base, you know, for a long time they're saying, oh, well, we can't find any records. And then they said, oh, come up and says, oh, well, they've been destroyed.
Right.
You know, it kind of makes you wonder, doesn't it?
It makes you wonder, and my thought on the Roswell situation with the document destruction is, though I can't prove it, and though it's possible, you know, that they were destroyed, my guess is due to the nature of that particular unit, the 509th, and what they were, considering they were the only United States Air Force unit to deliver the bomb, they were hand-picked gentlemen, they were of high caliber, I do not think those records were destroyed. I think what happened was those records were comfortably replaced or placed in somewhere else, and now that we're looking for them, they're hiding behind the blanket statement that all these records were destroyed. And technically they were right. A lot of records were destroyed. But I do not believe for one second that those records were destroyed.
Oh, I agree. I have an interesting question here that was sent to me. It says, because of what Frank Edwards said about a transition in type or shape of UFOs sighted, was there a change in the type or shape of the UFOs being seen in the latter days of World War II?
With what I actually saw in document form or the reports, the cigar shape seemed to be coming on the scene later in the war. And when I say late war, I talk about 1945. Of course, the war didn't end until September 1945. And in the Pacific Theater of Operations, a lot of the Army Air Force reports coming in, or what I had uncovered through testimony that's been in print through other literature, was the term cigar-shaped. And again, we don't know if the terminology was not used extensively. I mean, in terms of what was being reported, how was it being reported, and how many different types of terms were being used. Because, again, the reports we do have, we have to realize, were sanitized versions or condensed versions of the raw data. And to give you an interesting side note to that, that we can think, oh, well, maybe that took place. I read a paper of a gentleman who was doing night fighter research on the phenomena, and he learned through a lot of the through his interviews with pilots and men associated with this, that some of the units refused to report an object that they could not identify. So if it was something that looked like a jet, it went into the report as jet. And they refused to be looked at as like, oh, come on, you guys can't figure out what you're seeing, or all you see in those crazy lights in the sky, and they didn't want that. So they actually did not allow their intelligence officers to put that kind of report in final form. So we have a whole degree of issue during the war that the phenomenon can be masked behind. Every scenario can be looked at in two ways: German technology, Japanese technology, or we're looking at something unconventional and unexplainable.
Well, and then we know now that it wasn't Japanese or German technology, because they were thinking it was the Allies' technology.
Right. There is definitely those. We've read through the years how the Germans thought they were ours. My personal exposure to that was the interview with a pilot. He was a navigator who had, after the war, attended a Bell aircraft, I believe it was Bell aircraft, I guess convention or some type of meeting in Niagara Falls area. And basically, you know, all the men who attended and people attended were at one time with the Army Air Force or the Royal Canadian Air Force. And one of the people who showed up to talk about one of their guest speakers was an ex-Air Force intelligence officer. And the point I'm trying to get to is that during that lecture that he gave to the men about everything that occurred during the war, aircraft designs, aircraft development, jets, you name it. Well, after the event, Mr. Barber, the witness to one of the Foo Fighters during the war, approached him and said, "You know, you spoke about everything except for the Foo Fighters." And the intelligence officer looked at him and said, "Oh, you're one of the pilots who saw them." And he said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I know for a fact that they were being reported by the Germans, because one particular incident occurred on January 1st, 1945, where they were picking up communications between British and American night fighters who were seeing an object, what they considered not a jet or an aircraft. And they were also picking up chatter of a German night fighter pilot picking up the same thing. So it was definitely, the reports were being generated. And I hope that, you know, that helps a little bit in understanding that, you know, I can't see how investigations weren't being conducted by the Germans. You know,
oh,
if it
I
wasn't
agree.
There.
And on the other side of the coin, there were some major nighttime battles between the U.S. and the Japanese Navy during World War II. I know that it would have been hard for men in the heat of battle to notice anomalous lights in the sky. But was there a possibility that any of the reports of strange lights during any of these nighttime battles at sea, or, you know, in the air over the sea or over the island?
Yeah, I mean, even in combat, when you went to the Pacific Theater of Operation, the objects being seen by the United States Army Air Force was not called the Foo Fighter. It was now called the Balls of Fire, the same term that was applied by the British during the war to describe the same phenomenon. And what we understand, the 21st Bomber Command, which was under General LeMay, his intelligence team were crack. They were top of the line. You can only imagine how Curtis LeMay ran his ship of operation. And there were definitely, the Japanese were going to a great extent to throw things up in the air to counter the bombing raid. And there was a discovery of these sonically or remote control, they looked like V-1 rockets that had pilots in them. And they were basically a suicide. They were jet-propelled, and they would come up and try to hit the bombers and just take out the bomber formation with them. Well, they were definitely on the scene, but we don't know how many were actually used in combat. But the reports during April through July of 1945 were filled with hundreds and hundreds of sightings of ball-like objects that misbehaved in terms of they were just flying around radically and crashing to sea. So the first thing you think, oh, okay, this is ordnance related, or some type of flare, or some type of rocket just went astray. Then there were also the intelligence reports that these possibly were intelligently controlled, and they were jet-propelled, designed objects that the Japanese were trying to use at night. So, but what made it interesting is that these objects would follow the bombers out to sea for hundreds of miles. And they, if they were jet-propelled, they were obviously had a great capacity for fuel, and they weren't acting in that nature. So among all the ordnance, there were a few accounts that indeed were something significant during combat and not during combat in the Pacific, called balls of fire. They called them the circles of light. And it was a mystery. They just assumed that it was high technology with radar that the Japanese had and sophisticated aircraft. But at the end, there was still no definitive answer.
One of the incidences that you talk about in your book one of the first ones actually that you talked about in your book, these little, for lack of better terminology, metal looking discs about the size of a silver dollar were literally raining down on a few of these aircraft. Now, I'm having a hard time wrapping my mind around hundreds of these little things falling out of the sky and not doing some kind of damage to the aircraft. And like the pilot, where did these things come from?
Well, that is one of the great UFO stories of World War II up until recent years. I'd say as late as the late 1990s, were the so-called discs that were seen over Germany in 1943, and primarily during the air raid of Schweinfurt in, I guess that was October 14, I believe, 1943. And what people didn't realize, and I found a lot of documentation, Andy Roberts and Dr. Clark have found documentation, but I found quite a significant amount, that this phenomenon was indeed ordnance-related. And what it was, primarily, now you have to remember again, some of these sightings, phenomenal sightings, were mixed in among this ordnance. So when people were seeing what could have been an aircraft, they were reporting it as ordnance possibly. But these were shells, artillery shells, that went high altitude and would explode, and inside the shell were these discs around 6 inch in diameter. They looked like pancakes or donuts, and or they were dropped by high altitude German aircraft in the area. However, they were never seen to be dropped by the aircraft or fired. But some of these discs did hit aircraft, and in one instance took the wing off. And one bomber crashed, and some did lodge into another aircraft. So they call them the disc and donuts. And they were reported for many months prior to the Schweinfurt raid. And unfortunately, that had been misidentified as UFOs. They were UFOs up until recent years, but more than likely
unidentified floating objects.
Yeah, exactly. And they were sending a tremendous amount of things up in the air to take the planes down, literally dropping balls connected to chains, hoping that they would catch into the propellers. They would drop things, you know, the donuts, the slot, the little disc, whatever. They would drop glass or some type of ball that was filled with some type of sticky substance that would ignite upon contact with metal. There were those reports generated that I found. So it was a tremendous amount of things utilized to bring those bombers down. But among those is where we cannot lose sight that some of the sightings were not ordnance, but they were lumped in amongst the ordnance. And what makes it significant is the War Department was actually keeping record of this. And they actually had what they called a phenomena spec file. And I uncovered that at the National Archives. And the phenomena was given a number. Let's say like 9873 would be a flak rocket, or 9872 would be flare, whatever was designated for this decimal number. But the point is, it was phenomena that they were listed as. So they were keeping track. That's yet another investigative branch of the government that was monitoring the objects seen.
Yeah, an interesting comment that was posted in the auditorium said, remember what Gordon Cooper described around his space capsule, space firefly. I wonder if there was some kind of a connection. That's an interesting thought.
That is. That is. And, you know, a lot of the Foo Fighter sightings, quote, Foo Fighter sightings, were light. They were just light, and they were small. But typically it was one or two at the most, sometimes three or four, but we're talking about a singular event of something that sometimes was fairly large and not really acting like what Gordon Cooper had seen. I believe Gordon Cooper had also mentioned when he spoke before the United Nations that he had seen several flights of these sophisticated aircraft that were beyond the technological means of Russia or the United States, traveling high above what he considered, you know, he was considered the experimental test pilot, and he knew what we had, and they were far exceeding in terms of technology. So I think that was pretty much what he saw there was related to World War II. What he saw up in space, I'm not too sure.
Yeah, he had in fact, he was scrambled to go intercept. And, well, I don't know whether he was scrambled to intercept, but he was with a flight, I guess, of others out on a training mission. And the whole bunch of them saw this object out over Germany, and then he was involved with a sighting at Edwards Air Force Base where one supposedly landed.
Good point. Good point. I mean, we have so many high-caliber witnesses post-World War II identifying objects that you can say, wow, that's kind of like what was observed during the war, or, you know, years prior. So something was consistently being observed that, you know, if it had to be a structured aircraft, that is a given. We know that for a fact because these guys were seeing it during the day post-war also. So when people like Gordon Cooper speak about an observation, I'm willing to listen and pretty much realize that I'm hearing, you know, exceptional testimony of, you know, his observations can't be challenged too much.
I agree. There's a lot out there that I wish people would pay more attention to when they say what they do, such as, for example, Edgar Mitchell at the press conference at the National Press Club that was put on by Paradigm Research Group. That was big news for a week.
Yes, it was.
And he'd been saying that for, gosh, years.
It's incredible, and I mean, when that came out, I think, what, about 2 or 3 weeks ago? Most of my, I'd say all of my friends are skeptics, absolute skeptics of the UFO phenomenon. So they're great sounding boards. I always say, okay, well, listen to this, or read this, and tell me. So they all, you know, we banter back and forth, you know, very, you know, lightheartedly. But
yeah,
when he came out and spoke, a couple of them said, wow, that's pretty impressive. You know, what does he have to gain? Why would he want to trash his credibility? He's not really overstating anything. He's just saying what many other people have said before him and that type of situation. So you add it all up, and it's a cumulative effect. And they were taken back by that latest statement.
Out of all of the incidences that you've checked into, which one fascinated you the most?
I would say, of course, Mr. Leonard Stringfield, because I got to hear it firsthand. I got to hear the inflections in his voice. I got to hear him challenge himself, discuss his doubt, discuss his anxiety during the sighting. I got to listen to him tell how he anxiously jumped out of the aircraft to speak with the pilots to find out what it was he saw out the window that day. And they were whisked away for debriefing. And, of course, he had a task to do because of the emergency landing. He had to go about it. And, of course, then his after he got out of the Army Air Force, he began not too long after that to delve into the phenomena himself. And, of course, we know his history, how much he provided to UFO literature and how much he dedicated himself to researching the topic. I spoke with his wife, and she told me he was a writer, and he was the editor of the unit's magazine that he was in. And so she always said to him, Leonard, why don't you go and write something else? Why are you stuck here just writing about something that's very limited, or you can't identify, and it's always going to be in this realm? And he said he had to. It was his quest. He found it fascinating. He knew there was a truth to it that had not been given to the public. He was witness to it. He actually was affected by it. So, of course, and then he came in contact with people who had more extraordinary experiences, and that's what motivated him to keep going. So I'd have to say Mr. Stringfield impacted me the most, because I can read an extraordinary event on paper, but it's still not enough to get me that excited. And that's, of course, Mr. Stringfield was the one who actually instigated my desire to really dig in and try to find something.
You spent, gosh, I can't remember whether it was 3 or 4 years, going through the National Archives. How many documents, give or take a few, that you found in the archives that deal with this era and the Foo Fighter aspect?
Well, when I went into the archives, of course, the term Foo Fighter was nowhere to be found in any kind of directory or any kind of finding aid or anything. In fact, many of the archivists had never even heard the term, other than the band. So they always joked with me about the band in later years. But I went through tens of thousands of documents, all World War II, bombing mission reports, intelligence reports, like I said. And I'd say 99% of that documentation had nothing to do with the phenomenon. And it was, if I had to say out of those 4 years how many documents I pulled out of there that had anything to do with the phenomenon, it would be under a dozen. And that's not a lot. But the fact is, it was all documentation that had not been uncovered. The 415th Night Fighter Squadron documentation had been around for several years. And Barry Greenwood, Jan Aldrich, a lot of the behind-the-scenes researchers of today, historians, they had copies. They knew what it was. And when I first started my investigation, Jan Aldrich, Project 1947, and Barry Greenwood, they helped get me on my feet and show me what was available. But I remember something that was told to me, that when you do a historical work, don't rely on other historians' work. Go in and just look at the raw data. So the fact that they had copies of this material, I acknowledged it. I said, okay, that's what I have to go after. But I went in looking for that same document to determine if other documentation was missed along the way. And it happens. I don't know how many times I would go into a box of, that contained maybe 500 or 600 pages of information, and go back to that box a year later because I forgot something, and there right before me was something I missed. So there is a degree of that. It's a tremendous time investment to try to cipher through it, because you're not reading about too much about what you're looking for. It's combat and technical issues with the aircraft and just a host of things that I was discouraged several times along the way.
You think that the brain, after going through that many pages in one box, the brain would have a tendency to get a little bit numb and just kind of skim over instead of actually registering what's being seen.
Exactly. I became very adept at identifying terms or people or commands, and I would see a name or I'd see a unit, and then I would like, okay, now I have to really fine-tune. But I couldn't afford to sit there and read documents page for page, word for word. I became very good at realizing what to look for, where in the report to look for it, what kind of report would have it. So I would, let's say I would go into the National Archives on a day and spend 8 or 10 hours and pull, I'd pull 48 boxes. To go through 48 boxes of material is a tremendous effort to get through. It doesn't sound like a lot, but each box contains up to, several hundreds, if not 1,000 pages of material, depending on what kind of document it is. So I would sometimes get bogged down and only get through 5, 6, 8 boxes, or I'd flash right through 48, 50 boxes at a sitting because it just wasn't anything there. It was insignificant information. But I can tell you there is still a lot of classified documentation at the National Archives, air intelligence-wise. There are 1,600 boxes still classified from World War II to 1954. And those boxes may hold some other answers. But it's just, for one reason or another, this material is still classified. It should not be that way, but it is.
Did you find much in the way of the reports made by Robertson or any of the other people that were sent out to investigate this?
Well, I'm the first to uncover where the General Spatz, who was in charge of the United States Tactical Air Forces, and General Arnold, of course, and there's General Eisenhower's office, Schaaf dispatched Robertson by name in the report. So I actually have the report in 1945 that when the Foo Fighter observations were becoming heavy, they asked the scientific advisor to Eisenhower to look into it, which was Robertson, and they list him by name. So he was out conducting investigations. The air technical intelligence teams under General Spatz were conducting investigations. The U.S. Air Force, 8th Air Force, under General Jimmy Doolittle, were conducting investigations. General Arnold, who was the commanding general of the entire Army Air Force, had one of his top men, a guy named Joseph Chamberlain, I think his name was Colonel Joseph Chamberlain, who was writing all his speeches and doing a lot of his administrative work, actually asked him to look into the phenomenon. So there was, of course, Robertson. Then there was the most knowledgeable person of the war on the topic, and his name was Dr. David T. Griggs. He was involved in looking into the Foo Fighters and the balls of fire in the Pacific for General Arnold, for General Keeney, which was head of the Air Forces in the Pacific Theater of Operations. So up until recent years, many people thought there was no investigations being done because, one, we were at war. There was no time to chase after silliness such as these strange phenomena. There wasn't the manpower to devote to it. But that's because you have to look at it that even though it was considered a phenomenon, it was considered a potential weapon. So that in itself warranted investigation, and that's why my book shows, yes, that there was plenty going on, and plenty still to be discovered.
I find it so fascinating that Robertson, later on, after World War II and all this was done and over with, would head up a CIA panel investigating the subject of UFOs. It blew me away when I read that in the book.
Yeah, on that panel was, of course, the chairman, Dr. Robertson, who was an expert in strategic bombing effects, I believe, had to do with what took place after the bombings occurred. And so he was also connected to every top thing with technology. He was connected to what they called Crossbow, which was the V1, V2 investigations. He was part of the London mission, which was the liaison with the British government and the American government. He was involved with advisory groups to the Army Air Force generals. So he was at the top, and he was getting all that information. And then after hostility ended in May, he actually headed what they called the Field Intelligence Agency Technical. And it was his unit that received all the incoming intelligence reports, captured documentation, films, microfilms, facilities. Everything was coming in through him. And then on that panel also was Dr. Luis Alvarez. Dr. Luis Alvarez not only investigated the Foo Fighter phenomenon, but he was, I believe, the scientist who was instrumental in the design of the switch that set off the atomic bomb. And he personally witnessed Hiroshima. He was aboard one of the aircraft.
Oh, wow.
He was a radar expert. There was Dr. Lloyd Berkner. Dr. Samuel Goudsmit was on this panel. Dr. Samuel Goudsmit led what they called the ALSOS mission. And the ALSOS mission was the United States intelligence gathering effort to determine if Germany had an atomic bomb. And they were scared to death they did, because we did not know for sure. We assumed we knew, but we didn't know. And it was Dr. Goudsmit who actually went in and with combat troops, his team went in and would procure facilities. They would grab scientists, engineers, whatever, at their own risk a lot of times, because these guys were civilians, basically, being protected by U.S. troops, to get in there quickly, find out what we need, because we are going to be invading Germany, and we are invading Germany, and we don't need a surprise. So he was on there. Dr. Thornton Page was on this panel. But strangely enough, these guys reviewed what was considered the top evidence, the top film. I believe Hynek spoke before the group. I think Captain Ruppelt was there for Project Blue Book. And again, I don't think everything has been released, what was said. And the fact is, three of those men were actively involved with the Foo Fighter investigations in World War II. And if it was indeed a meteorological phenomenon, like I discussed early on, that one statement is very curious to me and holds my curiosity in terms of, I think we are dealing with something non-conventional. It was, if the term flying saucers had been popular in 43 through 45, these objects would have been so labeled. I find there's a real oddness that was included in that report. So
we have about 2 minutes left. He'd like to tell everybody the name of the book, where they can find it.
Sure. The name of the book is Strange Company: Military Encounters with UFOs in World War II. You can find it at anomalousbooks.com or amazon.com, or go to your local bookstore and ask for the book by name, and they can order it. They can special order it for you. Any Borders, Barnes & Nobles, whatever.
I really enjoyed
being on the show tonight.
Oh, I enjoy having you on. I love this book. I've recommended it to a lot of people, and so far everybody that I've talked to that has read it is just loves it. It's a great body of research. I highly commend your work.
Well, thank you so much.
Just,
and I appreciate
awesome.
The listeners for tuning in. I hope they enjoy it, too.
I'm hoping that a lot of them will go out and get this book, even especially those who are interested in World War II history. A lot of this deals with around the end of the war. And you really don't hear a lot of that.
What? I'm glad I was able to provide it. Like I said, hopefully it's just the foundation for what's yet to come.
And I was just going to ask you if there was another project in the works.
Well, I keep my ears open. I'm not going into the World War II period at this moment. I am currently researching World War II, but as of right now, nothing new has been uncovered.
Well, the research continues at least?
The research continues, yes.
Awesome. You'll have to keep us all informed.
Yeah, absolutely.
And on that note, we are all out of time. I want to thank you again, Keith, for joining us. This has been a wonderful 2 hours and very informative.
Thanks a lot. Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, we'll have to get you back again when you've got some updates for us.
Okay.
Well, that's all the time we have tonight. I want to thank everyone for tuning in, and also to thank all those who joined us in our Alpox Virtual Auditorium. You've been a great bunch of people this evening. Please join us again next Saturday on UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, UFO Synopsis. And until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.